our nation. I'm your guest host from Canada. Joining us in the next segment is Stephen Kinzer, one of my favorite authors, and we're going to delve into his book, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of the American Empire. We had issues last time up where we couldn't connect, and so you know, I did as much as I could from my memory, but the author is a far better source. But if I was in charge of any kind of educational system anywhere, this would be required reading in high school. And I'd probably start out with The True Flag and maybe like grade 10 to learn about where we went, how we got to where we are, to understand foreign policy, politics, history. This would be fundamental. And then the next year, I'd probably go into the Dulles Brothers, and we've done an interview on that that you can find in the Power Hour archives, to educate the young a little further on the work behind the scenes. And then as you mature, before you leave high school, you'd have to get Poisoner-in-Chief into your system so that you understand how diabolical things can be. If everyone, or close to everyone, understood the dynamics of true history in light, easy reading, the world would be a far better place, let me assure you. So, you know, if you want to buy a gift for someone who's a thinker, this is a place to go, let me tell you. You'll just enjoy it. If you love reading, you'll love Stephen Kinzer, and that's why we have him back again. Thank you, Stephen, for taking the time to talk to us.
It's great to be with you, and as you said, a lot of the stories that emerge in my books tend to be stories that Americans have forgotten or don't know about or were never taught. I think part of the reason for that is that the United States, like all countries, has a national myth. And these national myths tend to portray countries in a very innocent light. Some countries, like some individuals, are better than others at looking at themselves in the mirror and seeing themselves as they really are. Others find it very difficult to admit anything negative that they've ever been or ever done. And that's why I'm trying to redress the balance with some of the books you mentioned.
Oh, indeed, indeed. You know, that was one of the big lines to come out of that era, was my country right or wrong, and that somehow we put on rose-colored glasses when we're wrong and just keep stumbling along to go down a foul trail. And I was aware of the Philippine insurrection. I liked the era of Teddy Roosevelt. That was one of my favorite eras in history. And, you know, the writers, the thinkers, they're just stand alone, probably some of the best in American history, really. And the great debate about whether America should be an imperialist nation or stick to more constitutional values is something that is still of essence today. And to understand how it happened back then is very, very important. So as I recall from the beginning, you know, there was a terrible financial crash in the 1880s. And then from there, desperation comes in sometimes where, you know, some foreign escapades seem to balance the books. Take us back to those days and what was happening and where America moved.
You're quite right that these foreign adventures often begin with troubles at home. I remember in the Shakespeare play, Henry IV, he's on his deathbed. And the young prince comes to see him, and he's giving advice to his son on how to rule. And one of the things he says is, busy, giddy minds with foreign quarrels. So this is nothing new. The idea is you don't want people to be sitting around talking about what a bad leader you are. And in order to prevent that, you find enemies elsewhere. Now, the period that we're talking about here, the end of the 19th century, was a period of quite dizzying change in the United States. We did have a terrible economic crisis in the beginning of the 1890s. in addition to that, however, there were social and political forces running through American life that seemed very shocking and disturbing and disruptive. We had tremendous clashes between labor unions and police forces hired by management. These resulted in pitched battles in which people were killed. You had tremendous immigration coming into the United States. The cities began to become the key centers of power in America. Meanwhile, gender relations were changing. All sorts of different ideas were coursing through America. And it seemed like the old certainties and the old values were under threat. In addition, the wounds of the Civil War had not yet fully been healed. So all of this created a climate in which there was a need for some great unifying national project. And as so often happens with ambitious nations, the project became expansion and seizure of territories. As a result of these forces, the tinder was dry, so to speak, when the spark emerged from Cuba and pushed the United States towards the fateful decision of becoming an overseas power.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And then one of the biggest catalysts for this, like in any day, like when you talk project, the first thing to come into my mind is the project for a new American century. Kind of sounds like the century before that yet, is the power of the press to create the impetus for things we see. And Hearst and his newspaper chain were probably some of the best. Were, you know, what's the old saying in TV? If it bleeds, it leads. Well, even long before TV with the printed press, that was it too, is that you needed all these diabolical things to be a very popular grease for the wheels. And I guess the ultimate grease is patriotism and a war to sell your journal ad infinitum.
Well, I think you can make a kind of a comparison, as you suggested. So we had the project for a new American century at the in the 1990s, trying to create a kind of intellectual and political environment that would make it possible for the United States to attack the Middle East militarily and try to dominate that region. Then when the spark happened with 9/11, the intellectual and political groundwork had already been done. I think you can see something similar back in the 1890s. So there, you did have something like the Project for a New American Century. It didn't have that name, and it was not formally organized. But there were a handful of people in Washington who were determined that the United States should follow the path of other colonial powers. Theodore Roosevelt is the most famous of them. His closest compatriot was Henry Cabot Lodge, the senator from Massachusetts who became chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Alfred Thayer Mahan, the naval strategist, contributed to this group. So you had the same effort to create a climate that when the spark came, all the tinder was dry. And in this case, the spark came from the explosion of the Maine in Havana Harbor in February of 1898. But there's another comparison that you also suggest, and that has to do with the media. So if we look back to the American decision to invade Iraq, you'll see that, yeah, there was a core of true believers who wanted to get this project done, but they needed to convince the American public that this was a good idea. And in that effort, the American press was an invaluable handmaiden. Almost the entire press of the United States cheered the idea of going to war with Iraq, and that was a product of the success that these promoters of war had had over past years. Now, looking at the Hearst press in the period just before the American intervention in Cuba and other places, here's essentially what happened. Hearst was a young man in California whose father essentially wanted to get rid of him and gave him a newspaper that he owned in New York. Hearst went to New York and started up building up this newspaper, the New York Journal. He had great success in publishing the normal diet of sensationalist stories. Adultery, murder, child abuse, political corruption. He built up the circulation quite considerably. But after a while, stories like that tend to run into one another. They're repetitive. It's just one after the other. And Hearst, with a brilliant entrepreneur's mind, realized that what he needed is what journalists call a running story. That is a story that keeps happening, that unfolds every day, that's not just a 1 or 2 day story. And as journalists realize now, just as they did then, the best running story of all is war. As soon as you have war, you have the opportunity to create heroes and villains and battles and all sorts of episodes that grab newspaper readers and force them to pay their money for the newspaper. So Hearst quite consciously set out to find a way for the United States to get involved in some war somewhere. He really didn't care where it was going to be. It happened to be in Cuba, and Hearst was absolutely decisive in promoting the U.S. intervention in Cuba and the interventions that followed. But it could have been anywhere else. It just happened that Cuba was nearby, and there was various other circumstances that lent themselves to this. But if the United States Army had been sent to fight in Central Africa, that would have been fine with Hearst. All he needed was a big running story, and that's what he got with the Spanish-American War when the U.S. invaded Cuba in the spring of 1898.
Indeed, indeed. You know, we can just see it's almost like Rupert Murdoch and his newspaper empire, that when you have this long-running story, this is the key to, you know, profit. And the downside is, you know, what role do some of these media play in orchestrating or helping along some of these long-running stories as a profit motive as opposed to an idealistic motive? And, you know, in the interim, I came across a great old film because I love them. It was called Ace in the Hole. And, you know, the great old actors are just fantastic, too. Kurt Douglas plays a reporter who's pretty much burned all his bridges in any big city to be a newspaper man, and he ends up in a very small town and working for, you know, a very small market newspaper in Albuquerque. And he comes across a big story, a man's trapped in a hole. But if he just gets him out right away, then the story's over. So what he decides to do is to turn this into a long-standing rescue where interest is generated and people come from all over. You know, it turns into a circus practically. One of the other names for the movie was The Big Carnival. And they try to drill the man out from the top, which is the most long circuitous route to get to him. But it's okay. It's selling papers everywhere. And he's making deals with newspapers all over the world for segments of this story. Unfortunately, because they don't get to the man quickly enough, he dies. And it's Chuck Tatum, his role as the newspaper man, who actually has to, you know, basically hold his hand for his last moments on Earth and realize that he's done the wrong thing and this isn't right. And so in that regard, it's a brilliant film and a brilliant expose on how media can work and how it cannot work. And this is...
Well, I know that film, and I think you're right, that it points out some of the aspects of the mass media that we don't like to face. After all, in our system, the press is a for-profit institution, and it has to be aware of what readers want. There's a natural impulse to, for example, always to play up threats. It's just like the weather report. When you hear the weather and it says everything's going to be nice, it's going to be a pleasant day tomorrow, you don't feel the need to tune in to watch the weather forecast later. But if you hear there's threatening snow out there and it could be something awful, you want to pay attention. So in the same way, we like to intensify or inflate the threats that we face as a nation. If newspaper readers are told that actually we don't have any other countries that are threatening us and in the world we're quite safe, well, that doesn't excite people. That doesn't make them want to follow the news. If you tell them we're living on the edge of danger, we've got the evil Russians, and then there's the evil Venezuelans, and the Cubans are coming after us, and then there's the Iranians, and China's over there. We're surrounded by North Korea and the nuclear missiles. It makes people feel, oh, we're very vulnerable. I better be aware. I've got to be following all these huge developing threats. So threat inflation is a big part of media, and it definitely produces foreign conflict. Now, you ask about the profit motive, and that's certainly there. But what I notice in the American press when I try to understand why it is so unanimously in favor of this project of projecting American military power around the world has to do with the environment in Washington in which these stories are produced. You've got a large floating group of people who work for congressional staffs. They go to work for think tanks. They work in that foreign policy environment there, and they're working with policymakers all the time, and they want to get to be the policymakers when the administration changes. So because they're in such intimate social contact with each other, they tend to absorb a narrative that really only plays out in Washington. They don't see the world as it looks to people elsewhere, and they don't see the United States as we look to other countries. I think sometimes this is one reason why I have a different perspective on America's role in the world. It's that I didn't learn about the world going to a foreign policy institutes and then working for think tanks in Washington. I actually learned about the world by being out in the world. I was a foreign correspondent for many years, and I learned about American foreign policy from the perspective of the victims, the subjects, the people that are affected by American foreign policy, not from those people who sit in antiseptic halls in Washington and start talking about things like maximum pressure and collateral damage as if it's something all very academic.
Oh, indeed, indeed, indeed. That's the, you can't help but be inured to this story, you know, seeing how things unfolded in time. You know, maybe it's too soon to get into the Philippine War, but, you know, we had pressure, you know, Congress is coming up with the Teller Amendment to change the paradigm and grease the wheels to get us involved in things. Hearst thought the Maine was a great loss of the Maine was a great event. That was their 9/11 in their century to provide impetus. And it was debated for many, many long years whether the Maine blew up on its own or whether it was a covert act by the enemy we created. And that was debated for many, many long years. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that.
So the USS Maine was an American warship. And in the early weeks of 1898, under intense pressure from what were called the Jingos, the warmongers, people like Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt, President McKinley agreed to send this warship, the Maine, to Havana Harbor. What was it doing there? Well, there was a revolution going on Cuban revolutionaries were fighting against Spain for independence. The United States was not involved in the war, but under pressure from people who wanted us to get involved in the war, McKinley sent what it used to be called in those days a gunboat calling card. In other words, a message to everybody, particularly the Spanish, that the United States was there and we were watching. This would have definitely been considered a victory for the Jingos back in Washington because it created a situation that brought us closer to getting into war, which was their goal. So on the night of February 15th, 1898, the Maine exploded in Havana Harbor. This was immediately seized on, not just by people in Washington like Roosevelt and Lodge, but by by William Randolph Hearst, the great media baron. And he had headline after headline denouncing the Spanish for blowing up our ship. And the speeches in Washington were all full of outrage for the loss of over 200 sailors at the hands of the Spanish attackers. As you said, it wasn't even really clear at the time what had happened, but the reality of what happened became unimportant. What was more important is what Americans needed to believe had happened. And that was that we had been attacked in a brutal way. The press fanned this. Politicians accepted it. There were a few voices that we might have listened to. The chief U.S. Navy expert in naval explosives said to a reporter for the Washington Star, there is no torpedo or mine known to man that can cause this kind of damage to a ship. It couldn't have been an attack. And it wasn't until 75 years later that the Navy finally convened a court of inquiry under Admiral Hyman Rickover, a very famous military figure. They conducted a deep investigation, and they concluded that, indeed, the Maine had blown up from inside. The spark had set off the ordnance that had been stored inside the ship. So it was an accident.
Indeed, indeed. We'll be back on the other side of the break. Thanks for coming out.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, New Man of Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com. Does Big Pharma have a hold of you? ThePowerMall.com believes everything the body needs is provided by nature, unlike prescription drugs that aren't meant to cure but cover up your symptoms and contain addicting chemicals. Strauss Heart Drops are 100% all natural. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops by calling Jay at 1-877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at ThePowerMall.com today.
You know what my mission was when I started this, and I was so excited. I still am excited after 21 years. I said anybody who's got mouth must use Vitamir toothpaste and mouthwash if they want to stay healthy. I'm going to make sure that it is available to anywhere I can put the product.
You got a lot of zinc in these products.
Zinc inhibits plaque growth. Zinc is also known to have an antibacterial properties. Also, zinc works to eliminate bad breath by destroying volatile sulfur compound. Such an incredible product. And
wow.
I'm so proud to say my wife did that and saved my life, saved my mouth. And she is the mother of all the people who are using a Vitamer toothpaste and mouthwash in the world.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Buy from the good guys at theparamall.com. That's theparamall.com.
Hi, this is Catherine at the Power Hour. The Power Mall began when Joyce Riley discovered an all-natural soap that heals skin issues and can replace your bathing, laundry, and household cleaning products. That soap is Miracle 2 and is made from natural minerals and coconut extract with no added fragrances or colors and is naturally concentrated and biodegradable. I guarantee after you discover how amazing Miracle 2 products are, you'll recommend them to everyone you know. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today. You'll learn why so many people say, it's not just soap, it's a miracle.
Each and every one of you are very special to us here at the Power Hour, which is why we offer this special for you. Now through the Sunday, 10% off all Good Health Naturally products at thepowermall.com. That's right, all Good Health Naturally products are 10% off all week long. Call 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or online at our newly designed ThePowerMall.com store. Buy from the good guys. Buy from ThePowerMall.com. Hurry, sale ends this Sunday.
Welcome back, Power Hour Nation. Going back in time to look at the era of Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the birth of the American Empire in a great book by Stephen Kinzer called The True Flag. And we were kind of just reminiscing about dear old Teddy and some of his wild-eyed stunts and such in his South American trip. I was reading, and I posted on my website, conspiracy-cafe.com. I have a library section, and I put that book in there. And, you know, just thinking about the snakes that you had in the jungle down there was enough to turn me into another direction, that's for sure, home. But they muddled through under great, great torment. It was something about the explorers of the day. A lot of them were scientific expeditions to go into the most far-flung off-road. Could you, you know, imagine just there's no technology. You know, you're on your own. You know, about the only thing you could have to get a message out would be another person or a carrier pigeon or something, because you are completely alone, isolated, and cut off, which is something very, very difficult for the technological generation to even come to grips with, that there were days before technology, and you had to get by on your wits. And that alone is, you just see that generation just being so stoic for the physical difficulties that they would have to face. But Teddy Roosevelt was left with the keys to the store while the Secretary of the Navy was away. And he did something that you probably just wouldn't see in any era, that you were left with the keys to the store, but that you would actually do policy decisions that would get us into a war. Tell us a bit about that.
This was a remarkable episode, and as you say, it could never happen in the modern age because bureaucracy is way too far developed. So back in that period, we're at the end of the 19th century now, a little over 100 years ago, the Department of the Navy was absolutely crucial. It was probably at least as important as the State Department. You didn't have this instant communication, so what the Navy decided to do really was American foreign policy. After President McKinley was first elected in 1896, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts visited him. Lodge had helped McKinley get elected, and he said to McKinley, I only want to ask you one favor as to repay me for the help I gave you in getting elected. I want you to name my friend Theodore Roosevelt as the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Now, this was part of Lodge's great plan to bring America into war, to bring America to the position of being a great international colonial power. He knew that Roosevelt supported this idea. And if from the Senate he could get Roosevelt into the executive branch, that would be a wonderful connection that would help promote the project. So finally, after some persuasion and some doubts, McKinley agreed to name Roosevelt as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, even though he said, and he wrote that he didn't want to do it because he had heard that Roosevelt was always getting into fights with somebody. And, of course, that was true. The somebody wound up being other countries. So the Secretary of the Navy then, John Long, was elderly and ill. Theodore Roosevelt was young and vigorous and endlessly ambitious. So one day in the spring of 1898, Secretary Long took the day off to try a new mechanical massage machine that he thought might ease his back pains. Theodore Roosevelt arrived and found out that today he's the only guy in the office because the boss is gone. So he called Lodge over at the Senate. Lodge came over, and they decided, let's take advantage of this day. So Roosevelt started dashing off telegrams to naval commanders. He told all ships around the world to load up with fuel and be ready to move. He authorized large new enlistments for the U.S. Navy, and he took a series of other steps that pushed the war project a little further along. The next day, Secretary Long came back and was horrified to see what he had done, what Roosevelt had done. In fact, he wrote in his diary, I think Roosevelt caused an explosion in Washington about equal to the explosion of the Maine down in Havana. But neither Secretary Long nor President McKinley took any steps to counteract the orders that Roosevelt had given. So as a result of that one-day absence, the United States moved dramatically closer to the point where it was going to be ready to make war by landing troops in Cuba.
Indeed, indeed. This is, you know, just uncanny. You know, as I recall, too, I remember reading a statement in your book, too, about Henry Cabot Lodge, you know, implying before the Maine sunk that that would be, you know, something to be expected or a good thing to happen. You know, and when we realize now that it wasn't an attack from outside, you know, was it something from the inside to help this along? To sacrifice a ship to gain all kinds of foreign territory is not much on the grand chessboard unless you're a crew member on the ship.
Well, you're right that Lodge did make this comment when the Maine was sent down there, that there may soon be an explosion which could change everything. Now, that was taken at the time as meaning a political explosion. But in light of what happened, that sentence takes on a whole set of new meanings.
Indeed, indeed. And then we get the infamous Teddy Roosevelt resigning and getting into a military unit to complete his illustrious charge on San Juan Hill and make him a national and international figure and pave the way for the presidency. How did he do that?
This is really an amazing story. Theodore Roosevelt created himself. He invented the persona of Teddy Roosevelt. He was a great fabulist. He created this image of himself as the intellectual thinker who was also the backwoodsman and soldier and man of action. I reproduce in my book, The True Flag, a photo that Roosevelt used to hand out with him out in the wilderness, where he's got his coonskin cap on and his buffalo robe, and you can see the rough terrain behind him, and he's got his rifle with him. But if you look down at the very bottom of the photo, you can see that it's all a curtain, and he's in a studio of a photographer actually in Manhattan in New York City. So that was all kind of an example of how Roosevelt created a kind of bogus image for himself. Now, his emergence as a military hero fits perfectly into this background. So when the Spanish-American War broke out, when it became clear that the United States was going to send troops to Cuba, Roosevelt immediately wanted to go. He always had a fascination with war. He had always wanted to be killing something, and here was his chance. So he resigned from his position as Assistant Secretary of the Navy and decided he'd go to war. Now, in those days, the military units were organized by state. So in order to become commissioned as an officer, you had to be approved by the governor of that state. So Roosevelt appealed to several governors, but they effectively laughed him out of the office because he had never been in uniform. He had no idea about war or commanding troops or field tactics. So finally, one of his friends, another one of the great promoters of American imperialism, found a way for him to get appointed to a military commission by the territorial governor in New Mexico. So he went out to New Mexico and he got himself commissioned as a lieutenant colonel. And then he started recruiting troops. So he recruited a lot of his fellow lacrosse players and golf champions from the clubs back in New York and in Cambridge, as old Harvard men. He had a few cowboys. It was a kind of a strangely mixed unit. The press was kind of fascinated because Roosevelt had this big persona. They were trying to come up with names for this unit. They were going to call it the Fifth Avenue Boys because so many of them came from wealthy circumstances. But finally, one of them came up with this idea. They called them the Rough Riders. So Roosevelt, because he was so accessible to the press and he had this oversized persona, was the perfect kind of a figure for William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper publisher. Here was a guy build up into someone that everybody would want to read about. And then when Roosevelt finally did make it to Cuba, he again was portrayed as this great hero, even though he was only engaged in two firefights while he was there. His first firefight was when he led his men into an ambush. And then later, he spent a couple of hours on a horse in what became mythologized as the Battle of San Juan Hill. But it was only because the press was so eager for heroes and Roosevelt was so appealing that a person who really had very minor military achievements was presented as this great hero. And among the people who believed this nonsense was Roosevelt himself. He actually campaigned for years to get himself the Congressional Medal of Honor, despite having only been in uniform for a few months and having a total of 2.5 days of combat experience. Naturally, that was rejected, although later Bill Clinton gave Teddy Roosevelt posthumously the Medal of Honor for his so-called great deeds of bravery climbing up San Juan Hill in Cuba.
Embarrassing to people who really earned that award, no doubt about that. But after, you know, we conquer Cuba, then we move on to the Philippines, which is you know, kind of like that generation's Vietnam, where we're supposed to bring freedom and democracy, and there are indigenous people who pretty much want to rule themselves and look to America as a friendly power to liberate them from Spanish control and develop them into, you know, a free state like America. And that just turns upside down. We had a leader there, Emilio Aguinaldo, and he ends up being, you know, basically the enemy, because we're not going to allow people with a darker complexion rule their own destiny, because it's American corporate power that will rule your land. Tell us about the Philippines and their leader.
The Philippines situation is so odd because the American leap into the Pacific, which was so fateful actually happened by accident. Everybody in America could have told you what the War of 1898 was about. It was about Cuba. Does the United States going to control Cuba? Is Spain going to control Cuba? Are Cuban revolutionaries going to control Cuba? That was what the war is about. We actually wound up taking Puerto Rico as part of that project, but that was also reasonable because Puerto Rico was next door. But the Philippines was on the other side of the earth. There had never been a book about the Philippines published in the United States. Even President McKinley admitted, I couldn't have told you where those darned islands are within 1,000 miles. So why? Why did we decide we would want to seize this archipelago with 7,000 islands about which we know absolutely nothing? It all was an accident. As we were preparing for our invasion of Cuba, which was aimed against Spain, we realized that since we were declaring war on Spain, Spain might be expected to attack the United States in retaliation. That meant that the American mainland could be hit by Spanish warships. So it became important to find the Spanish fleet. Where is it? We want to make sure that it's destroyed or that it doesn't come close to our coast. Well, it turned out that the Spanish fleet was not in Spain, and it was not in the Caribbean. It was anchored in a place on the other side of the world, which happened to be the Philippines, which had for hundreds of years been a Spanish colony. So it was because of this that the U.S. Navy was sent to the Philippines to destroy the Spanish fleet so that the Spanish fleet could not come and bomb California. But then came the question, okay, we've destroyed the Spanish fleet and effectively destroyed Spanish power in the Philippines. Now what do we do? What do we do with the Philippines? Of course, as you point out, there was an independence movement going on there. There was a revolution going on. And many Americans, like Mark Twain, for example, saw the solution very simple. We congratulate the winners of the revolution. We shake their hand. We say, you overthrew a colonizer just like we did. And best of luck for your new country. But instead, those people faced the strong argument, we don't leave. Once the United States raises its flag in any country, we stay there permanently. And this is what led the United States to take its first overseas colony, the Philippines. And that not only shaped the history of the Philippines and the Pacific, but it imbued in Americans this view that wherever the United States shows up militarily, we insist on being the dominant force permanently. So even though we later gave the Philippines independence in the 1940s, we've always remained as a country that was trying to oversee the Philippines. So this idea that America got involved in the Philippines was hugely influential and shaped the course of all world history because it marked the arrival on the world scene of a new imperial power, one that had limitless ambition. And when the treaty was being debated in the Senate that would allow us to take the Philippines, many senators warned about this. I quote in my book, The True Flag, speeches by several senators who said, we'll never be able to go back from this. Once we set out on the path of taking other countries and projecting our military power overseas, we will become another colonial power like all the others, and we'll never be able to return to just being a normal nation that minds our own business. This is exactly what happened.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And it was, you know, for a land that professes freedom and rule of law, the war in the Philippines was just as brutal as any anywhere, and with extreme loss of life to the Filipinos, and you know, the use of torture, and just it was just total debauchery.
One of the interesting aspects of this war is that in the United States, it's totally unknown. This was a war that, as you said, took hundreds of thousands of casualties and involved the U.S. in its first big torture scandal. It became the place where we made our debut on the world scene as fighters against independence for local peoples. Yet nobody in the United States even knows this war happened. It's an extreme case of a retreat into the national myth of innocence that we talked about at the beginning.
Oh, indeed. I know there was I believe it was a New York newspaper that was showing, you know, they didn't do waterboarding per se. It was more they filled you full of water and hit you in the stomach with a rifle butt. And, you know, just showing that on the front pages or the hanging, there was another incident where they were hanging young children. And, you know, the language that you'd use on the front page wouldn't even be spoken of anymore. And that was just an accepted process by many people back then. And, you know, that's what really, you know, boils my blood that we don't know this history, we don't repeat it again, and we don't talk about it again, because if we don't, then the sins just carry on and carry on from one generation to the next. What were some of those atrocities?
As you said, what we call waterboarding now was originally introduced to the United States by our exposure in the Philippines. And so it was a fairly similar process. It's a torture used by overfilling a person with water or plunging his head into a bucket of water to simulate drowning. So when I was writing The True Flag, I became interested in this. So it's obviously a technique that the United States has continued to use all the way up through Guantanamo and other Abu Ghraib and other places. We learned it in the Philippines. This is how that tactic became assimilated into the U.S. arsenal. But I became curious, how did the Filipinos learn it? Where does this come from? Where's the idea of waterboarding originating? So I went and investigated it, and I found out that the Filipinos actually learned it from the Spanish. And the Spanish had picked it up because it was a torture used during the Inquisition. This is how they tortured people who didn't have the right religious beliefs. So the Spaniards picked up these delightful torture techniques, brought them over to the Philippines where they were the masters for several centuries, taught them to their Filipino allies. Those Filipinos then taught them to the Americans. And the Americans have gone on to use that technique as a part of the interrogation arsenal. So I say that what happened in the Philippines for Americans was in many ways a kind of loss of innocence. Americans had to face the fact that their soldiers had tortured people. This all became quite public. It was all in newspapers. The soldiers were writing back letters themselves explaining what they had done. But Americans had to pull back and tell themselves, well, as Henry Cabot Lodge put it, when you have a war against savages, you get lured into doing terrible things. And there was only a few bad apples that did it. You have come up with all these excuses, and you become inured to it. We were also being told about the terrible things that were happening in the Boer War in South Africa, what was happening at the Boxer Rebellion in China. So we began to shrug our shoulders and say, this is what war is. If we are going to be a power that wants to promote goodness and peace and freedom in the world, we have to realize that there are people out there who oppose our view of what is goodness and peace and freedom, and we have to kill them. So this is what I mean by saying it's a loss of innocence. It's a realization that we have to grow up and be like the other powers of the world and not cling to illusions that we can behave differently in our civilizing quest.
Well, one quote I found in your book that I really, really liked was from Booker T. Washington. And, you know, he made it quite plain, until we conquer ourselves and make no empty statement. When I say that we shall have, especially in the southern part of our country, a cancer growing at the heart of this republic, and I'm glad he called it a republic,
that shall one day prove to be dangerous as an attack from an army from without or within. And part of that is just there is that inner struggle within all people. Are we lured to the dark side or not? And by and large, that can be a difficult one to even comprehend, never mind master. And being a child in the 60s with the Vietnam War, I think that just turned me off from that style of imperialism completely and totally. It was too great a cost for the Vietnamese people. It was too great a cost for the American military. And, you know, I'd always hoped we would have matured at that point not to do it again unless it was the last dash effort of fending off an invasion. But that's not the case, unfortunately. And that's why it's so important to know these histories and to understand them. And, you know, I still think it was a great era. I love the way people write. There were so many great Americans that you quote in your book in the debate that I never heard of before. And I got to go through it again and make a list, really, and read their words again and again and again, because that was probably one of the greatest debates in history. It wasn't like today where it's just hyperbole and sound bites for CNN or anything like that. It was true reasoned discussion from great minds.
Yeah, you did have the sense that people were much more educated about history. When you read the debates, you see constant references to Pliny the Elder and battles in Persia, things that you'd never dare to bring up with a senator today. Even the bad guys in that debate were brilliant. They were debating ideas. And I agree with you that there are some fascinating figures. One of the greatest things about writing this book is what obviously you felt from reading it, which was discovering some of these less known figures. You mentioned at the beginning, my country right or wrong, but I actually found out that the person who said that really said my country right or wrong, when right to be kept right, when wrong to be put in the right.
They leave those little details out at the end. Well, we're out of time already, Stephen, but we'll have to play again sometime because we love your work and we want to get it broadly out. Stephen Kinzer, look him up, buy his books, expand your mind. Thanks for coming to Power Our Nation. I got Max Egan up Monday.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.